yourself a song to sing, and sing it till you're done. Yeah, sing it hard and sing it well. Send the robber barons straight to hell. The greedy thieves who came around and ate the flesh of everything they found. Whose crimes have gone unpunished now. Walk the streets a screaming now.
Greetings, all you 99%ers. This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus. This is Alternative Visions. Okay, we're going to keep talking about central banks. And as you know, they are in the news here this past week, particularly in Europe and in the U.S. What happened here is central banks in Europe, particularly the Bank of England and the European Central Bank, signaled that, like the Federal Reserve, the U.S. Central Bank, this past week, that they may be raising their interest rates as well, and even considering maybe selling off their massive balance sheets that they've accumulated by buying all the bad debts of private banks over the last 8 years. Okay, so that set off a kind of a bond route, as they're calling it in the press, a global bond route. What is a bond route? That means that prices of bonds start collapsing, start falling. And there is a inverse relationship between bond prices and bond interest rates. So if the banks, the central banks, said they're going to start action to raise interest rates, it means bond prices start falling. Now, the Fed, U.S. Central Bank, started raising interest rates last December and has done it in several steps here this past month, the latest, increasing the federal funds rate, the rate that the Federal Reserve influences from 0.25% to 1.25%. That's a fairly rapid increase in 6 months. And that has started certain sectors of the economy worrying that maybe the cost of money in borrowing is going to go up and that's going to reduce their profits and so forth. But it hasn't really reached a level where there's a panic in the U.S. in terms of the cost of money and investment. My analysis has been that the Fed is not going to continue announcing interest rate, short-term interest rate hikes here much longer. And instead, they're going to start selling off their massive balance sheet. And now we got the European Central Bank and the Bank of England, who typically follow the Fed, now giving signals that they're planning to do so as well, i.e. raise interest rates and even behind that, maybe start selling off their balance sheets. Now, what are the balance sheets? The balance sheets of the central banks are this massive amount of debt that they've exchanged from the private banking system and some non-banks, giving the banks and non-banks money in exchange for these bonds and securities. In the U.S., it's been buying subprime and other mortgage bonds and treasury bonds. but in Europe and Japan, the latter in particular, it's not only buying mortgage bonds and government bonds, but it's buying corporate bonds, subsidizing the corporate bond market and corporations. And in Japan, they're even buying stocks. So what you've got is the central banks, these institutions that have been created to prop up the private capitalist banking systems, getting deeper and deeper into subsidizing these systems to keep these banks and these financial asset markets humming. They can't keep them humming at the level they would like on their own without central bank involvement. So the central banks, if you look over the last decade or so, have been creeping into a deeper role of subsidizing the private banking systems. Yes, it's really a case of subsidization of the banks going on right now. You could have argued in 2008-09 that the central banks, the Fed and others, jumped in and bought the bad toxic bonds held by private investors and banks in order to bail them out. But by 2010, most of them had been bailed out. So why did the central banks continue for another 8 years injecting massive amounts of liquidity, in other words, money, buying up these assets, continuing to buy up these assets for years and years? Well, the only explanation is that they're subsidizing the banks, and they are subsidizing the private asset markets, the stock markets and bond markets and so forth, because it's the banks that loan to investors who then go and buy the stocks and the bonds and so forth. So there's this relationship between the central banks providing all this money, buying the bad assets from the banks and other investors, it's not just banks anymore, and then those banks and investors loaning money out and pumping money into stock markets and bond markets and derivative markets and foreign exchange markets that cause the bubbles in those markets. Or these investors who get the free money, because it's virtually free money with from the central banks, who get this free money, then take it offshore, you see, and invest in financial asset markets, stock markets, bond markets offshore, and also into real assets, you know, the growth of the economies, the real economies offshore. Since 2008, a lot of that has been financed by the central banks of the advanced economies, Europe, North America, Japan, right, creating all this liquidity, and their liquidity gets diverted back into these emerging markets, including China. All right, so the growth occurs outside the advanced economies, outside the U.S., as a result of money created by the central banks in the U.S. and Europe and Japan. And a lot of it simply gets, as I said, diverted into financial asset markets. Okay, 8 years of free money, and all this diversion results in financial asset bubbles in stocks and bonds and foreign exchange and derivatives, which we don't know because they don't report it. Like huge amounts of price increases, accelerating financial asset prices. Some of it flows out into China in emerging markets. Some of it simply gets borrowed from the banks or issued by corporations issuing their own corporate bonds, because it's very cheap now, because if you keep the rates low by the Fed, all the other interest rates stay low as well. So corporations just simply issue their own corporate bonds because it costs so little, interest rates are so low, and then they turn around and redistribute that borrowing in the form of dividends and stock buybacks. As I've said many times on the show, in the U.S. alone, that redistribution has amounted to almost $6 trillion now since 2010, when the banks were all bailed out and, you know, we're no longer in recession. The game kept going. And the low interest rates, the free money, the borrowing, shuffling it offshore, multinational corporations, plowing into the stocks and bond markets that bubbled, and redistributing the profits in the form of dividends and stock buybacks. And, of course, with the big tax cuts on capital gains under Bush, continued under Obama, those stock buybacks and dividend payouts just were retained. The profits were retained because the taxes were so low. So you find the 1%, the investor class, gushing with new profitability and new income. And, of course, that drives the income inequality trends. The accelerating of capital gains is the primary cause of the income inequality. Yes, wages have been stagnant, and that has exacerbated the problem. But the real problem is on the finance side. It's not the minimum wage not rising relatively compared to the big tax capital gains tax cuts, which are even coming bigger now, with all the dividends and stock buybacks made possible by the very low interest rates made possible by the central banks pumping all this money into the economy, into the banks, and so forth. Now, how much has this pumping amounted to? Well, officially in the U.S., the QEs, quantitative easing programs, where the Federal Reserve goes and directly buys assets, bonds, mortgage bonds, so forth, from investors and banks. We've had three versions of these. $4.5 trillion has been the balance sheet. In other words, that's the amount that the government has printed money and given it to the banks, and the banks then loan it out and all this other stuff happens. $4.5 trillion. In a way, you should envision this as the Federal Reserve, the central bank, taking the debt off of the private corporations and private banks' balance sheets and putting it on its own balance sheet. It's just transferring that debt. That's what that $4.5 trillion is. Well, how much is it in other central banks? Well, in Europe, European Central Bank, $2.7 trillion. Equivalent dollars of euros, right? In Japan, $4 trillion. An economy one-fourth the size of the U.S. Massive in Japan, right? Britain, they're approaching $1 trillion. Okay, that's just what's there now, you see. It's actually higher than that. It's actually higher than that. If you added up $4.5 trillion, $2.7 trillion, $1 trillion, that's $3.7 trillion, that's $8.2, that's $12.2 trillion just in QE, direct purchases by these four central banks. $12 trillion of printed money pumped into the banks flows into all these financial markets and offshore, or in dividends and stock buyback payouts, which are kept by the 1%. While the rest of us struggle with part-time contingent gig temp jobs and no wage increases for 10 years. It's actually more than $12 trillion. Why is that? Let me explain. The $4.5 trillion on the Federal Reserve Central Bank's balance sheet does not represent the cumulative purchases of private assets by the central bank. What do I mean by cumulative? Well, if I'm buying bonds, if I'm the central bank buying bonds from private investors and so forth, I'm adding this to my balance sheet, you know, QE1, 2, and 3, I got $4.5 trillion. Some of those bonds are being paid off and run off, as they say. But the Fed, since we stopped QE, or completed the $4.5 trillion, it was $4.5 trillion in 2014. Since 2014, some of those bonds have been paid off and retired, matured and retired. But the central bank, as those bonds have been paid off and retired, has bought additional bonds on top of that to keep the $4.5 trillion. So actually, the total cumulative amount of QE bond purchases by the Federal Reserve is in excess of $7 trillion. Now, that's just the U.S. Federal Reserve Central Bank. How much has been the cumulative purchases in the Bank of England or European Central Bank? Okay, the Bank of England ceased its initial QE program about the same time as U.S., but then with the Brexit thing last year started a new QE program, so we don't know how much more cumulative has occurred there. The European Central Bank started in 2014, is now buying close to $70 billion a month, and the same with the Bank of Japan. about the same, $70-80 billion a month of purchases of stocks, bonds, so forth. All right, some of that retires if it's bonds, is matures and so forth, and they keep buying more. So what's the cumulative of all these central banks for almost 10 years now of buying up the private securities of private investors and private corporations and private banks? Well, it's probably somewhere close to $15 trillion. Now, you can't tell me that the central banks aren't subsidizing the system by buying up all of that, the demand for those assets and the liquidity, the money that's injected as part of that demand gets reinvested in other financial asset markets and offshore. And the dividends and the paybacks, stock buybacks, those investors reinvest that as well in stock and bond markets and foreign exchange markets and derivative markets as well. That's why we have a bubble in stocks. And we had a bubble in bonds, but that bubble may start now to unwind. That's what I mean by the bond route starting in Europe. But it's also spilling over to U.S. bonds, which, starting with government bonds, have risen in interest rates and bond prices have fallen this past week. That's why investors, you know, the savvies, are saying, well, do we have the beginning of a bond route going on here? You know, this $15 trillion in direct liquidity injections by central banks isn't the whole story either. That's just from the QE, quantitative easing, direct bond buying. The Fed is also, and other central banks, have also continued their normal bond buying through open market operations, right, and discount rate window operations. Those are traditional ways that weren't sufficient when the 2008 crash occurred, so they had to engage in some additional emergency measures like quantitative easing. So really, you know, how much have the central banks pumped into the system since 2008? Well over $20 trillion. Don't tell me they're not subsidizing the system. Capitalism in the 21st century cannot continue on the basis that it had in the 20th century. Particularly mid-20th century. You know, this problem began to emerge in the 80s and 90s and 21st century. Now it's quite obvious. You know, if you look at the history of central banks, what do central banks do? In my book, Central Bankers at the End of Their Ropes, coming out in a couple weeks, I describe the evolution of central banks. See, central banks are not really government institutions. They are a kind of capitalist corporate banking corporation. They're different than regular banks, but they're not a government agency. You know, that's a false impression. The Federal Reserve is a corporation. It issues stocks. It pays dividends. It makes profits. Well, who does it pay dividends to? Who buys its stocks? Well, the private banks own the central bank. It has its own independent source of financing through the private banks, who own the stock, who receive 6% dividend payouts, and so forth. And the stockholders, the banks of the Federal Reserve districts, 12 of them, as stockholders in a corporation, determine who the board of governors is. In other words, they select the governing committee of 9 in each of these Fed districts. And the president of the Fed district is selected by the nine governors in the districts. Now, according to the law, 3 of those Class A governors, they call them, are bankers. 3 more are non-bank businessmen who are often bankers or ex-bankers, you know, working US college presidents or something like that, right? Nonprofit CEOs, or banks that are heavily indebted to the regional banks. So there's six who are always bankers, or pro-bankers. And then by law, there's supposed to be three who are community people, but those community people, governors on the Fed districts, you know, are also heavily influenced by the banking industry. As I said, some of them are ex-college presidents who become community representatives, you know, or retirees who used to work in the banking industry or associated with nonprofits or something like that, right? Once in a while, you get one or two people who aren't really bankers or pro-business bankers, but, you know, it's an indirect way of the bankers dominate, and then they select from amongst themselves, or from amongst their banker majority, they select their president, their district president. And there's 12 of them, and they send that district president to Washington to sit on the Federal Reserve National Bank Board. 12 of them. Now, seven governors are appointed through the nomination congressional Senate approval process. So you've got seven appointed governors, and you have 12 Fed district presidents dominated by the bankers. Now, in the reforms of 1933-35 of the Federal Reserve, because the Federal Reserve contributed significantly to the Great Depression, causing it or exacerbating it. So there were reforms in 33 and 35, you know, and this is where these seven governors were added to the Federal Reserve National Central Bank. Because before that, when the Federal Reserve was created in 1913, it was all banker-run. All nine on the committees were all banker-selected. Okay, so we have these little reforms in 33-35 where, you know, you're going to have three in the districts, three of the governing committees and district banks are going to have to be community people, which they aren't. And then you have these seven governors appointed by the president and so forth. You know, who puts up the appointees? Well, bank lobbyists have a big influence over that, who gets appointed. And they make sure that some of those governors, seven governors of the Federal Reserve, they make sure that they're pro-banker as well. They're supposed to be appointed, these seven governors, for 14-year terms, but as I said last week, the average amount of time that they serve is 2 to 3 years. And then they go off and work for a bank or a hedge fund or something like that. So we got this revolving doors problem going on between these governors who's supposed to be independent serving 14-year terms and the banking sector. So the banking sector controls ultimately, not absolutely, but ultimately influences, controls the Fed district presidents, the 12, who vote rotation on what's called the Federal Open Market Committee, makes decisions about interest rates and so forth. And the other seven, of course, have this problem with revolving doors. So, indirectly, the private banking system is able to dominate the Fed and its decisions nonetheless. But you won't have that, that point argued in the press or by academics. They say, oh, the Federal Reserve is independent. Independent of whom? They usually mean independent. We need this Federal Reserve needs to be independent of the government politicians. What a joke. They're not independent, you know. When it comes to these appointments, the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, the big banks in New York pretty much vet and determine who's going to be their district president. And if you look at the staffing of the Federal Reserve of New York, these people all come from the big banks. So it's a very clever way of the banking system really continuing to dominate the Federal Reserve, regardless of the decisions and reforms, the token reforms made in 1933-35. Okay. Well, in my book, Central Bankers at the End of the Rope, I describe and explain how when the Federal Reserve was created, it was all banker-dominated, and even after reforms, it is still banker-heavily influenced. I mean, you see, once in a while you see an example. This is this Fed district, president of Richmond District here, Jeffrey Lacker, I think his name was, resigned quietly, forced him to resign because he got caught funneling information to the banks in his district. Well, how many times did these guys not get caught? You see, the central bank, the Federal Reserve, has more impact on the economic lives of the citizens of this country than any other institution. But it's also the most undemocratic institution. And in my book, I talk about some of the reforms and the constitutional amendment necessary to change the Federal Reserve and restructure it and make it responsive to the needs of the whole country, to democratize the Federal Reserve and get rid of the banker influences within it once and for all. Okay, so I don't want to jump too far ahead. Let's go back to our thread of discussion of what's going on this week with central banks. Well, I mentioned about the signals given by the ECB and BOE, Bank of England, here about they're going to follow the Fed on raising rates and maybe selling off their balance sheets. That was indicated by the last Federal Reserve meeting that they were looking at that as well, so that means it's a signal it's coming. Now, if you sell off the balance sheet, if you sell off that $12 trillion, you know, that's money being pumped into the economy, well, into investors, and that's going to raise interest rates as well. It's going to increase the demand for securities, which, you know, simple supply and demand, increased demand raises price. So what we're going to get here is a rise in the price of money, which is called the interest rates. So you get interest rate increases two ways. You get the Fed declaring it's going to raise, you know, the federal funds rate, and you can also get it by pumping money into the economy, selling off the balance sheets, which raises interest rates as well. Question is, how high can interest rates go in the U.S. and elsewhere before it precipitates a credit crunch? You know, you look at the history since the 80s and 90s, every time we've had an extended period of very low rates that fed financial asset bubbles, and then the Fed started raising interest rates, every time those interest rates rose, it precipitated a financial market crash. That occurred in the late 80s, early 90s here in the U.S., and it occurred in the late 90s, precipitated the tech bust, and also precipitated the currency meltdown in Asia in 97, 98, the tech bust in 99, 2000. And then, of course, once the Fed started re-raising interest rates from one low of 1% in 2004 or 5, started raising it to 5%, in 2006-07, what happened was we got the implosion in the housing market, which is spread then to all the other credit markets because of the derivatives relationships now in the credit system. Okay, so it doesn't take much to raise interest rates before you precipitate a contraction. And now rates are going up. No one knows at what point further rate hikes will precipitate a crisis. It certainly won't require 5%. In my own view, I think anything that's approaching 2%, given the weakness of the economy out there and the extent of the bubbles, you know, when bubbles get too high, investors look for an excuse to take their money and run. Well, the bubbles have gotten very high. The stock market bubble just keeps going. Well, why does it keep going with these developments? Well, because investors think they can always time the market, you see. They always think, well, you know, I can get out when this thing looks like it's going to crash. I can time the market. So I'll just keep riding that horse as long as it keeps rising. But most of them don't time the market very well, you see. And the crash comes and they get stuck. And there's some reasons why the markets, the financial markets, stock and bond markets and currency markets will not be able to absorb much of a rate increase as in the past. But history shows you raise those rates, you're going to precipitate a bubble crash. And that's what happened in 2006-07. That's what happened in 2001-01. That's what happened in 97. That's what happened in 88-90. And it's going to happen again. It's a historic fact you cannot avoid. History shows time and time again. Okay, so the Fed is raising rates and may raise them even more with balance sheet sell-offs here. And the Europeans are signaling they're going to raise rates, and that caused nervousness in the global bond markets and sell-offs that have begun in the global bond markets, the bond route. Is it a bond route? You know, has the route started, or will it simply be a cyclical thing and we'll return to settling down and more hikes in stocks and bonds? Well, we'll see. We'll see. But people are getting nervous. Nervous. All right. Last week, too, the Federal Reserve conducted its annual phony bank stress tests. Another important decision. You know, important decision is signaling by the Europeans that they're going to follow the Fed. The Fed announced it the week before, raising rates, right? Selling off balance sheets. That was last week. Europeans this week. And this week also we got the results of the stress test. Bank stress test. This has been going on since 2009. And why do I call them phony? Well, because the stress tests are conducted to show that the banks are in good shape in order to encourage stock buyers to buy bank stock. In that sense, they're phony. Well, why are they phony? Look at the way they're done, right? How is a stress test conducted? Well, first of all, the banks are involved in defining, with the Fed, defining the test. You know, that's like giving college students the answers to a test before they take it. you know what the answers are while you're constructing the test. The Fed then, once they've constructed these tests along with the private banks, right? There's about 35 of them in the U.S. It then gives these tests back to the private banks and says, okay, there's three scenarios. Given your assets and your investments and so forth, banks, tell us how you would perform given these three scenarios. It's a take-home test. Well, the banks then manipulate the numbers, you know, to show the Fed that they passed it. Then the Fed has to decide whether to believe them or not, whether to believe their numbers. Well, what the Fed does, it always believes their numbers except for a couple of them. You know, it always leaves a couple. Well, we don't pass you. We don't like your numbers, you know, as a kind of warning to the rest to, Don't manipulate this too much. We're going to let most of you go, pass, but don't manipulate it too much because we're still watching. All right, so, you know, in the past, the Fed, the worst of the bank, Citibank and Bank of America, sometimes did not pass because if you don't pass, you can't then redistribute your dividends to your shareholders. your profits to your shareholders, right? And the way banks work is that they pretty much redistribute all their profits to all their shareholders, you know, dominated by a few very, very big shareholders. You know, they take the money and they don't hold on to it. They spill it out to their shareholders. Well, if you don't pass the test like Citi and Bank of America hadn't in the past for a few years, then you can't pay out your dividends. If you don't pay out your dividends, investors don't buy your stock. Well, then that means the government has to provide liquidity and capital. So the government, the Fed, you know, likes to make the banks look good so it doesn't have to buy more of their bad assets. And it lets the investors buy the stock and build the capital in the bank. Okay. Now, this Dodd-Frank reforms here that are, you know, slicing through the administration and Congress will make it even easier. In this last stress test, by the way, Citibank and Bank of America were allowed. We're passed. So, okay, guys, you can pay out dividends now to your shareholders. Okay. I'll talk about that and finish how much that amounts to, right? Only some obscure little banks, a couple of them very obscure, you never even heard of them, small banks, you know, smaller banks, have been exempt. And more banks are being exempted from this stress test charade here, right? So that's how the stress tests work. You know, the stress tests were originated in 2009 to make the banks look like they weren't collapsed, which they were. In 2009, the Fed bailed out the banks with QE and so forth, and then did the stress test to show that phony stress test to make it look like the banks were really that bad off so that investors would buy their stock and increase their capital in the banks by buying the stock. A stock is capital. And then Congress suspended mark-to-market accounting, as it was called. In other words, said that you, the banks, can lie about your accounting, you know, manipulate your accounting. That accounting manipulation and the stress testing cover made the banks look better than they were and brought back in investors to buy the bank stocks. Okay. And so we've been doing this phony stress testing every year, as I described, to keep the ball rolling. Okay. Back to the rate hikes and the balance sheet sell-offs here. Right. Other global central banks followed the Fed. The Fed is the central bank of central banks globally. Right. And ECB started QEs. The U.S. and the Bank of England started QEs in 2009. ECB, $68 billion a month in March 2015. As I said, Bank of England renewed it last year, and Bank of Japan, right, is doing it since 2014. And all this money, this $15 trillion plus other, you know, amounts to direct subsidizing of the private banking system. You know, one of the functions of central banks has always been described as lender of last resort. In other words, when banks were in trouble and they couldn't borrow from each other, then they could borrow from the Federal Reserve through the discount window. And when that wasn't enough, that's when QE started, special auctions started, and so forth. You know, but the banks, the private global banks, are on life support still. We have over $5 to $10 trillion in non-performing bank loans around the world, minimum. That's just looking at Europe and Japan and the U.S. $5 to $10 trillion. If you add China non-performing bank loans, probably about $5 trillion there alone. So we get about $10 trillion in non-performing bank loans. What do we mean non-performing? It means that the banks have loaned money to non-bank companies and they're not paying the principal or interest. In other words, they're technically in default and the banks could shut them down. But when they do that, they cause a bigger awareness of the crisis, so they haven't been shutting them down. So, you know, you've got, you've heard of it maybe, you know, in Italy, the banks in Italy, you know, non-performing loans, and in Spain, in Portugal, of course, Greece. Who knows where else in Europe? Okay. You've got $10 trillion. That's not a small amount, right? How many banks and shadow banks are on the edge is another question. Quite a few. So the global banks are on life support. That's what the free money is all about, you see. That's life support. That's central banks are functioning as economic ventilator machines to the private banking system, which is comatose in many of its segments, some of it not, but some of it is really comatose. It's like, you know, the left arm is completely numb, you know, and the right leg below the knee is completely numb. Pumping free money, oxygen, into the patient banks here has been going on, and this has become a permanent function of the central banks, subsidize the private banking system. Because if you took this away, if you took all this free money away, if you took the ventilator off of the patient, you know, and said, okay, patient, you got to survive on normal air, not this hyper-free money oxygen, well, the patient would be very much in trouble. So the central banks are toying with the idea, maybe we should remove the ventilator a little bit in steps. But no one knows if, in doing so, when the patient can't breathe on its own. Is it required to survive rarefied high-octane oxygen QE? Or can it survive as it did in the past, in the 20th century, without this direct subsidization going on? See, what are the functions of the central banks? One, in their origins, central banks are only a couple hundred years old. In their origins, how did they start? They started out as private banks that aggregated, raised money for the capitalist state government, you know. One of the banks among all the private banks took on that function. So central banks started out as private banking institutions emerging out of the private banking system. That's why they still are a kind of corporate bank. A strange hybrid, but nonetheless a bank. And over time, the central bank was given a monopoly over currency creation, because you had every bank creating its own currency, and that was destabilizing. So in the mid-19th century, you know, only 150 years ago, central banks started assuming the function of controlling and issuing currency in the money supply, centralizing it. That was another big evolution in central banks. I talk about this in the book. And then by the 20th century, as we started getting banking crises and need to bail out, and the Treasury and the governments, parliaments didn't want to get tagged with bailing out these big banks, they created the Federal Reserve, and other central banks assumed the function of lender last resort. In other words, when the banking system is in trouble, they're going to bail it out by creating money. When it was in trouble, bail it out, lender last resort. Okay, in the 21st century, we've gone to a new level here, however, and that is, even when the banks aren't in trouble and need a bailout, the central bank is pumping money into them nonetheless, subsidizing the private banks, not just bailing them out when they need to, which is kind of a way of saying, if we weren't subsidizing, maybe they would need a constant bailout. Which says something about the capitalist banking system's stage of evolution, you see. Well, this past week, you know, it looked like there are signals that, you know, maybe they're going to take them off of the ventilator. The free money, QE, low interest rate, free money ventilator. And that's causing a little bit of initial panic among the private bankers and investors, because they don't know at what point you reduce the ventilator by raising interest rates that they'll stop breathing, right? But the Fed this past week said, okay, you know, banks, phony stress tests, some of the capital cushion, the money capital cushion we've made you build up over the last 8-10 years, you can start, you, the banks, now can start passing on to your shareholders in more dividends and buybacks. Well, that's why the bank stocks just surged this past week. The big surge in the stock market and the Dow is in the Fortune 500 is a reflection of that. Bank stocks surging. Don't tell me central banks don't subsidize stocks. Yes. But you see how cleverly indirect all this now functions? So people can't really see what's going on? Well, the decisions by the decision by the Fed this past week, you know, was said to the banks, you can start taking some of this cushion. In 2009, this bank, the bank, U.S. bank's capital cushion was about $500 billion. Well, they, and 5% of risk assets. Well, now it's 12% of risk assets at $1.5 trillion. And the Fed is saying, well, you know, you can start just redistributing some of that $1.5 trillion to your shareholders. You can increase your dividend payouts, stock buybacks. Right. Now, the estimates have come out that this decision will increase dividend and stock buyback payouts to bank shareholders up to, and in some cases exceeding, 100% of bank profits over the past year. You see, banks redistribute everything to their shareholders. That's why, you know, you get so damn rich in banks and banking and investment. From 65% of profits payout last year, which was increasing significantly from previous years, now it's 100%. Payouts will increase to 100% of bank profits this year as a result of this Fed decision last week. Some banks, like Chase, J.P. Morgan Chase, announced that they're going to distribute 110% of their profits this year. Well, how can they do that? Well, because they got this big, big cushion of $27 billion as a result of all the subsidization going on for 10 years. Okay, so 110% they're going to pay out. Well, if you're a stock holder, you know, or a prospective bank stocker, wouldn't you buy bank stocks? Knowing that there's going to be a dividend increases and stock buybacks driving up the price of stock? Well, sure, that's why the stock market, bank stocks, surged this past week. Citigroup, which was effectively technically insolvent, bankrupt in other words, in previous years, now announced 82% of profits will be distributed as a result. Now the Fed allows it to. That's $18.9 billion. So that 12% cushion that's been accumulated is now going to decline, probably closer to the 5% at the time of the crisis, as all part of this deregulation, you see. It's all about enriching investors. That's what it's all about. Now, one of the Fed district presidents who left a year or so ago, named Kosher Lakota, right? At the time of leaving, saying said that, look, the banks need a cushion not of 12%, but 24%. 24. Well, we're reducing it from 12. Thank you, Janet Yellen. Maybe you get to keep your job here when it expires next January. I doubt it. All right, we're going to have a Goldman Sachs guy put in charge of the Fed, the chair. Put your money on it. Probably this guy, Cohen. Okay. So that was a Fed decision this past week. You know, phony stress test, one. And secondly, okay, you guys can redistribute your cushion now and dividends and payouts. And bank stocks went through the roof. Ah, but we got this, is there a bank route, a bond route coming issue, you know? It's not around the corner, but it's coming. And we have this hiccup in the bond markets, right? Because if interest rates go too high, you know, bond prices are going to inversely go too low. Now, the bond markets are far more important than the stock markets. You know, it's like double, triple the size of global stock markets, bond markets. You know, that's the core of the capitalist financial system, the bond systems, right? And if bond prices drop too much too far, right, that's going to raise the cost of non-banks borrowing. Interest rates will go up too much, and they won't be able to borrow, except at a rising cost. Now, if you're a part of the bond market called junk bonds, like the fracking and oil sector, right, raising your cost of borrowing may just push you over the edge into default, right? Because you've taken on so much debt already to expand the fracking industry. And, of course, when you take on debt, there's principal and interest that has to be paid, and you've got to keep rolling over your bonds in order to keep paying it. And if you can't roll over your bonds, then you can't pay it, and then you're facing defaults, right? And if the energy sector junk bonds default, it will spill over to the rest of the junk bond market, and that could spread over to the investment-grade corporate bond market. And if that happens, then you've got a general decline that will go on the stock markets and foreign exchange markets. Okay, and already we're seeing in Europe, not in the U.S., because in the U.S., as I said, the stock market keeps bubbling because of, you know, the bank prices and so forth, and tech keeps bubbling in the U.S. That's keeping it all up. But in Europe, it looked like this bond market route that may spill over to stocks. And if it happens in Europe, you know, and then here you're going to have tech stocks who are especially vulnerable. We could see a repeat of the 2000 and 2001 tech bust here. Now, what's happened in the last 10 years is that the stock markets themselves have changed. A lot of investors are in what are called index funds and exchange-traded funds. In other words, they don't go buy individual stocks through brokers because these guys are, you know, more wrong than right. They just put them in a fund or an ETF, which, you know, sort of aggregates different stocks and different bonds. You could have a bond ETF as well, right? But what this means is that if these prices start falling and it spills over to the stock markets, right, people aren't going to be able to sell their ETFs and their index funds as quickly as they want because they're locked up. And that's going to just cause a deeper panic in the stock markets and an even faster decline in stocks. Okay, these are possible scenarios here. Should this bond route deepen and spread, you know, it will have a negative impact on stocks, and stock markets are even more vulnerable today than they once were. Okay, what this all means in a broader historical sense is that central banks, when I say are at the end of their rope, it means that there are fundamental contradictions at the heart of central banking that are now emerging in the 21st century. The most fundamental, of course, is this massive liquidity injections by the central banks going on since the 1980s, which accelerated in the last in the 21st century and accelerated even further since 2008, is a big problem. liquidity, in other words, injecting of all this money into the banking system, when there leads to excess debt and excess debt leveraging, and all the available of money and borrowing of money to invest in financial asset markets creates bubbles in those markets. And those bubbles in stocks and bonds and foreign exchange and derivatives and so forth cannot continue to rise. At some point, some big investors are going to take their money and run, and those prices are going to collapse. Now, the prices collapse, but the debt remains. Right? The principal and interest on all that borrowing to invest in financial assets and or real assets like the fracking and junk bond market, right, has to be repaid. But the money flow to repay it collapses with the price. But the debt remains. You see, that's the owner's thing about debt. It doesn't go away. Your ability to finance it may decline or go away, but the debt doesn't. And when it doesn't, then you default. And default simply means you can't make the payments on your principal and interest. So what happens when that occurs, and that's what happened occurred 2008-09, well, the central banks come around and they inject even more liquidity to enable the payments into the banks and non-banks. Well, wait a minute. The excess liquidity led to the excessive debt and leveraging and bubbles in the first place, so isn't the central banks, in injecting massive liquidity as they have, $15 trillion plus, right, creating more liquidity to stimulate even more bubbles, more debt? Yes. The problem of excess liquidity leads to the excess debt and the bubbles, and then that becomes the solution of the central banks to the problem it created with excess liquidity. You see, so the problem created becomes the solution to the problem that they created, becomes the next problem they create. That's a major contradiction in the global capitalist banking system. Oh, well, how much more debt has all this liquidity created since 2008? $60 trillion in private sector corporate debt. We're repeating the same problem as we have several times since the 1980s, each time bigger and more serious. That's what I mean of the big contradiction in central banking. And the central banks continue to subsidize the private banks and create this problem. Okay. Next week, we'll talk about the current Yellen Bank.